Good afternoon. I call the House Higher Education, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. I will note for the record that a quorum is present. I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes from March 4th. Representative Robbins, would you move that motion?
Happy to move the minutes of March 4th. Approval of the minutes of March 4th.
Thank you. Representative Robbins moves the approval of the minutes from March 4th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Minutes are approved. First item on the agenda today is we have the Midwest Higher Education Compact today, and we would love to have you to hear from you today. Please introduce yourself to the committee and continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
We're on the table. We can hear you. Thank you.
Great. My name is Susan Hegard. I'm the president of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact, and I have spent many nights and days in this building in my past life. I worked for Governor Carlson and Governor Polenti, and I also worked in a couple of the state agencies. So it's really fun to be back here. For those of you who aren't aware, I'd like to have my colleagues introduce themselves.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Samra Uskadam, and I'm with the Midwestern Higher Education Compact, and it's great to be here today.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Hegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in your packet, I'm just going to reference several things. There's a highlight sheet. There's also some user lists for our technology contracts as well as our programs. I'm going to be working from the slide deck. You have a printed copy of this, but of course it's also available through the laptop here. We are a compact, and for those of you who don't know about compacts, compacts are essentially have their roots in the United States Constitution. They allow one state to do business with one or more states without the federal government's involvement unless you're doing something that bumps it up against their jurisdiction, like transporting nuclear waste or something. So there are compacts for hunting and fishing and water and dentistry and doctors and nurses. So we are a compact that's focused on higher education. We were founded in 1991 through the Council of State Governments, CSG, of course, the acronym that you're probably all familiar with. And we have 12 states in our compact. They're the states that really mirror the footprint of the Midwest Census region. We have 60 commissioners and alternates. About half of those commissioners are legislators, a few governors' policy aides, and then half of the other half are higher education leaders, so from little campuses all the way up to large systems. Our budget, we're very grateful for the appropriation that comes from the state and through you. It's $115,000. It's the lowest of the four compacts. There are three other compacts like ours, one in the west, one in the south, and one in the northeast. We're similar but different, and I'll explain some of that in just a moment. But that $115,000 is critical. You multiply that by 12, that's $1.38 million. And it's a declining part of our budget because we're getting some revenue from our technology contracts. But that commitment from the state really allows you to access and tap. It's a contract, all of our programs and offerings. We're in state statute in every state, and the statute's similar across the 12 states. Those states really are, if you don't know the Midwest Census region, it's North Dakota, South Dakota. We swing down through Nebraska and Kansas, across through Missouri, and then all the way up around to Ohio. And this is our, we've visited four states, and we've got two more next week, and then six more after that. So here are the Minnesota commissioners. Typically, two are appointed by one by the House, one by the Senate, and then the other three are appointed by the governor. And that's very similar across the region. Here in Minnesota, you'll see that Rachel Croson from the university, the provost, is one of the commissioners, Dennis Olson, who heads up the Office of Higher Education. And then we have an opening from the speaker's office. We hope to get that appointment soon on the House side. In the Senate, it's Senator Omar Fateh. And then, of course, Scott Olson, who heads up the MinState system. And then we have an alternate, Paul Cerkvenik, with the private colleges. So our value to Minnesota, I always like to talk about this in terms of value proposition. We're just, incidentally, we're a nonprofit. for tax status reasons, but we really are a little different than some of the other folks that will be presenting before you, because we're a compact. We're an instrumentality of state government, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So our value to Minnesota, we have cost and time-saving contracts and programs. We have policy initiatives, research, and convenings. And so I like to talk about it in terms of us having two sides of our business. One are these cost savings programs and contracts. The other side of our business is the policy and the research. And what we really do is we start things up, we can sunset them, we have a lot of flexibility. We really try to listen on these visits during this legislative time to find out what the pressing issues are across the region. So in terms of the cost savings contracts and programs, we have technology, hardware, software, services, student health solutions through United, and then other insurance programs. We also have policy initiatives. So right now we have an initiative on dual enrollment, open education resources, or OER. Those are course materials that are an alternative, free to the student, an alternative to textbooks. And then we also have a program that has, of course, another acronym, MSARA. It's distance education. In the past, if you wanted to offer an online program to another in another state, you had to register in every state where you wanted to do that. Now you just have to do it once if you meet certain standards, and that's through us. The savings to Minnesota, to Minnesota is $9.26 million. So that's pretty good ROI, we believe. Those savings, the state is the member, but the savings are realized by Minnesota colleges, universities, school districts, state, and local government, students and their families through the programs. That's an 81-fold ROI, which is significant. Of those savings, $2.3 million are on the technology contracts, and that's one area where in addition to higher education, both public and private, local units of government and K-12 districts can take advantage of our contracts. And those entities, really, the key contracts are through Dell, Oracle, Xerox, Campus Guard, and others. And the revenue that we derive from those compacts, we get a percentage. But the real savings is for the user. It's the savings roughly around 10%, but also we, because we're an instrumentality of state government, we negotiate the contract. It's turnkey and ready to go, so you don't have to issue an RFP and spend all that time and energy on the contract. Then that savings on the distance education that I mentioned, that's $4.5 million. The balance of those savings go directly to students and their families through the Midwest Student Exchange Program, and that's $2.8 million. That's a program that we're really taking a hard look at, because with the elimination the elimination of out-of-state tuition in many cases, it's just not as relevant as it used to be, so we're looking at that program now, but it was quite robust at one point in time. That would sort of sit alongside some of the other reciprocity, state-to-state reciprocity programs that you're familiar with. Like North Dakota and Wisconsin. We also supported in the past grant funds for Minitech's network library system, and then we provide research to the state on many topics. So if you have a research request, something you're interested in, we'd be happy to provide a response to that. We've had requests related to governance structures and cost savings and physical infrastructure, how to fund, bonding buildings and that sort of thing. But we have a lot of reports on our website, too, that you're welcome to tap. We also had a FAFSA summit. SAMRA took a significant role in organizing that summit. During our visit, we heard of all the challenges with the rollout of the FAFSA. Well-intentioned effort by Senator Lamar Alexander to simplify it, but the implementation was just dreadful and very, very difficult for many people. So we pulled a summit together. Nine Minnesota leaders attended, but we had leaders from across the Midwest who attended and shared kind of best practices on how to help families and parents and others, faith-based groups, nonprofit organizations and others, figure out how to get students to fill out that FAFSA, because if you don't fill out the FAFSA, you leave money on the table. And then we also have had folks attend our technology meetings. One of our key benefits, I think, that we offer is that depending on the topic, we convene folks, so we sometimes do that virtually through a webinar or something, but we also pull people together on key topics across the region. So I wanted to just give you a Oh, I wanted to also just mention the user list here would refer to the contracts that we have, and you'll see all the way like down to the waterworks and the fire department and school districts. They're all the users of the contracts, and then also the distance education program users. But I wanted to share some of the data, and I've done this every year, and I wanted to just share some of this data with you. These are just a sampling of some of the different ways in which you can look at your state. And for Minnesota, I'll start with attainment. I did some work with the Lumina Foundation in the past on attainment, and so I really felt like these slides are a helpful way to think about the state in context. So attainment means any credential beyond high school. That could be a certificate, it could be a four-year degree, it could be a two-year degree, or something beyond that. So in Minnesota, we have one of the highest levels of attainment in the United States. 62% of our Minnesotans have a post-secondary certificate or higher, compared to 55% nationally, and we're moving in the right direction. And so one of the key things I think to notice, and I'll highlight this in the next slide, is that you want a broad cross-section of workers and students, right? You want techs, and you want folks who are engineers and doctors and everything in between. And so what we encourage folks to think about is look at your economy, the key industries, and then figure out and work with higher ed to figure out how to provide, you know, the educated and trained folks to fill those jobs at wherever they are in the spectrum. So this slide illustrates where those degrees fall in Minnesota, those certificates and credentials. So in Minnesota, residents have attained various types of post-secondary credentials ranging from industry certifications and college certificates to bachelor's and graduate's degrees. 38% of residents don't have a post-secondary credential. So I'm going to just walk through this slide with you. The blue here, the 6%, would represent people that don't have a high school diploma at all. 20%, that's orange, that's a high school diploma or like a GED, it's equivalent. 12% have some college but no credential. And I think what's important about that category of folks is that that might be a mom, you know, who stopped out to raise children and intended to come back, or maybe not. But it also would capture people who started and never finished something. And those are the people that that you read about who rack up a lot of debt and they never finish whatever it is that they started. Indiana's had some interesting efforts to try to address that population. Then the industry certifications are the purple, the college certificates are the green, and then the lime green would be associate's degrees, the light blue would be bachelor's degrees, and the maroon color would be graduate degrees. So that's where that falls in Minnesota. The thing that's also important to realize is that you might have counties in this state that are far, far below that 62%, and other counties that are far above it. So here's another way of looking at data. This comes out of the Western Compact, and this, I think, reflects parts of the population that are growing. This really looks similar across the region except in North Dakota, where their overall population is growing. Why? Because of the oil industry and the related businesses there. But by and large, this is a pattern we're seeing in the Midwest as opposed to the rest of the country. The overall population's declining. The population that's white is declining a little faster, and the part of the population that's growing is non-white. So that's just another lens and way in which to look at the data over time. Then enrollment. Now, I say this with a caveat. This data is 2 years old. There's always a lag in some of this data. And this is an average. So there are probably, you know, the U of M perhaps, and maybe, you know, one or two of the Minn State schools, maybe more than that. Some of the private colleges might see upticks in their enrollment. But on average, the undergraduate enrollment, this just captures public institutions. At Minnesota, public two-year and public four-year institutions has declined in the past decade. So the orange line would reflect the public four-year institutions, and the blue line would reflect the public two-year institutions. There are a lot of questions about why that's happening. You know, I think as we move away from COVID, you know, we're seeing some of the regularity move back again. Some people just haven't gone back. And so there's a lot of research being done to figure out why that is. Are they just getting jobs, you know, instead of going? Are they not seeing the value, you know, in it? And which parts of this sector are being affected more than others? So we'd like to see some data. The data next year will be really important to look at. This side reflects more students migrating out of Minnesota than migrating in. Don't flip out on this slide, to use a technical term, because this is just a year after graduation. We have much larger populations in general than our bordering states. And so a lot of our students, as you know, might go to North Dakota, might go to South Dakota, might go to Wisconsin, but the data would show that by and large they come back home. And there's a terrific project with the Census Bureau that's been going on. I know Minnesota's part of it, as well as the other 12 states, other 11 states, that looks actually at that data beyond 1 year. It looks 5 and 10 years. And I learned about this in Iowa. They're able to show that if you look out 5 years or 10, a lot of those people in Iowa come back home once they're ready to settle down and raise their families. And so that's a really interesting project. But this would just...
I'm going to pause you just for a second. Representative Scott has a question.
Thank you. And thank you for these really good graphs. I'm enjoying these.
Sure.
I don't suppose you would have a graph that's not seen here, but it would overlap the graph on the bottom of page 5, which is, I think, 2 slides back from this that one, and then which is the high school graduates are projected to decrease. So showing that high school enrollment and then overlapped with well, I guess it wouldn't be an apple. I'm wondering on the next slide, it says undergraduate enrollment in Minnesota, and it's a slight decrease. And I just wondered what that looks like juxtaposed to student population going into college. You know what I'm saying?
Madam Chair and Representative
Ms. Hegarden.
Are you talking about, so you're looking at the slide with the enrollment pool, kind of those projections of what the population looks like, and trying to figure out how to compare that against that enrollment trend that's reflected
yes.
on the next
yes.
slide?
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
Okay, all right, we'll take that back.
Thanks.
To our folks. Thank you.
Ms. Hegarden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is another way of looking at this migration data across the Midwest. So you'll see in most of these states, if they don't stay home, they really are going to school somewhere else in the Midwest, by and large. So our people tend to stay within the region and not kind of head off to a coast or to warmer temperatures, maybe until they're employed later on. Then the final 2 slides reflect net price. So these, again, there is a delay in some of this data too, but the net price really is once you look, take financial aid, the Pell Grant, the state grant in Minnesota, we're very fortunate to have a robust financial aid program here in Minnesota. Many states I visit don't. And then any institutional aid as well. And then that's pulled off the sticker price. So in this slide, you'll see that the average net price for low-income students in Minnesota public two-year institutions is higher than the Midwest and national, but lower than South Dakota. Now, what we did, though, is we took Pell-eligible students, and those would be roughly families from with $30,000 and more income. Then we also, that's blue, and then we showed families from roughly $110,000 in income. And there is a lag in this data as well. So it'll be interesting to see how some of the newer scholarship programs shake out. We might see that data next year because I think the implementation was last year. And then here it is for four-year institutions. The average net price for low-income students in Minnesota public four-year institutions is lower than the Midwest and national and lower than Iowa, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So you want to pay attention to your border states because that's typically where your students will go. And with that, I am finished with the presentation. I just wanted to make sure I left time for questions, which I may or may not be able to answer here, but we're happy to follow up with you. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hegart. And in your packets, members, too, there is, because they are a nonprofit, they did provide, there are, in your packet, you've got the most recent audited financials and their 990, and then kind of a summary of their government and non-government sources. But again, they are different than all the other nonprofits that we are having come in because this is a compact and we pay a membership, basically membership fee, which is a little different. So with that, I'll see if any members have questions. I don't know how many of you have gone to any of the events that they've hosted. I've gone to a couple. Really great information. It kind of keeps... And it's interesting. I'll be interested to see what the graphs and charts and that data looks like in a year or two when we look back at the changes that we made with the North Star Promise and North Star Promise mm-hmm. Plus. And then also we kind of created a huge hole in the state grant program here in Minnesota. So $210.5 million projected shortfall in our state grant program, which of course is almost one entire year's worth of grants. So we were a bit too successful or something here in Minnesota. We had about a 7.2% increase in our two-year institutions. That is after your spreadsheet that you have. So any questions from members? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your presentation, and we'll stay in contact. So it looks like you've got someone that needs to fill a spot, and we'll see what we can do about that.
Madam Chair, thank you so much. I really appreciate if you could ask about that. And members, it was great to be in front of you today. Thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Hegard. Okay, members, the next group coming up is MICC. So Minnesota Independent College and Community is coming up. They are also a nonprofit. They are not in our base. They have been in, have been out. So they have come to do a presentation because they would like to be back in our base. And they're going to talk about money that they have gotten in the past. Also in your packets, you have that full complement of financial information as well. So if you look in your packets, members, you do have the most recent 990, their audited financial report, their annual report, and I believe they're going to go through their annual report here with us to kind of let us know a little bit more about them. So again, this is MICC, M-I-C-C. And with that, I will, now they're all settled in, I will turn it over to you to please introduce yourself to the committee and start your slide presentation.
Wonderful. Thank you. For the record, my name is Amy Goodmisted. I am the CEO of Minnesota Independence College and Community, otherwise known as MICC. Chair Rarick and members of the committee, I sincerely thank you for your time today. At MICC, we are dedicated to empowering young adults with autism and neurodiverse differences by providing specialized post-secondary college program and lifelong community support. As the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder continues to rise, the need for high-quality, accessible programming has never been more urgent. Families across Minnesota and the country are searching for solutions that provide their loved ones with a path to independence, meaningful employment, and social connection. MICC is that solution. We recognize that affordability is a critical factor for our families, and we are deeply grateful for the state of Minnesota's financial support in making this transformational education accessible. Your investment allows us to serve individuals from diverse socioeconomic backgrounds, ensuring that all young adults, regardless of financial means, have the opportunity to reach their full potential. The funding you have provided this committee provides need-based tuition relief to our Minnesota resident students. At MICC, we take our responsibility to our students, families, and supporters seriously. We maintain the highest standards of financial stewardship and program excellence, as demonstrated by the following achievements. We are accredited by the Commission of Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities, also known as CARF. Annually, we conduct independent financial audits to ensure fiscal integrity. We are at the platinum level of transparency through CANDID, which is formerly known as GuideStar. And we have a 4-star rating with the Charity Navigator. And the meetings and all the standards of the Charities Review Council. These recognitions affirm MICC's dedication to accountability and reinforce our unwavering commitment to providing life-changing services with the highest level of successful outcomes, trust, and transparency. I'm thankful that some of you have been able to be to our campus and see our community firsthand, but for those of you who haven't, I'm excited to introduce you to Evan, who will take you on a tour of MICC on your screens.
Hi, I'm Evan. I'm a graduate of MICC. Let me tell you, half the stuff I do around here, I never imagined I'd be doing around here. Part of our school's success comes from a non-traditional campus. We have classrooms located in apartments, homes, and businesses here in the local community. Ever since MICC was founded in 1996, we've been here at the Colony Apartments. We've converted two buildings into offices and classrooms. We have three programs, college, careers, and community. We're going to start with college today. Behind me is our Welcome Center, where our admissions team meets with potential students and their families. And across the street, we have Donaldson Park, a key facility we use for exercise, leisure, and getting acquainted with nature. Our students use the park for team building, walks, picnics, and fitness electives.
Looking good, Evan. Don't forget our fleet.
Oh, yeah. For some activities, we have a fleet of MICC vehicles for student and participant transportation. Above admissions is our advisory center. Each student in our college program is assigned an advisor whose job it is to help guide our students on their journey through independence. Sometimes it's done through one-to-one meetings in a sensory space or a media room with the guidance of an advisor.
Let's head over to our main building now.
Hey, Amy.
Hey, Evan.
That's Amy, our executive director. She's pretty smart. That's what the script says, but she is pretty awesome. This is one of our busiest spaces here on campus. On either side of me, we have student common areas. Upstairs, we have administrative offices. The student center is where people hang out in between work and classes, doing everything from hanging out with friends and watching TV to doing stuff on your own like puzzles. Our computer lab offers regulated access to the internet. The transportation classes meet in here and go online to plan bus trips. And the personal finance classes often meet in here to balance their checkbooks.
All right, everybody, today in budgeting and banking, we're going to be working through different money scenarios.
This is one of our main classrooms. During the day, we learn about independent living skills and social skills. But at night, well, we're still learning skills, but in the form of cooking for each other and playing games.
Wait a minute. Evan?
Yeah?
Haven't you taken this class before?
Yeah.
Would you mind taking your tour outside, please?
Of course. Let's go. Speaking of outside, this is our private, beautiful courtyard donated and built by our awesome community. Out here, we have classes, bonfires, and our gardening club meets here. And the vegetables and herbs they grow are used in our cooking electives. At the back of the building, you'll find another classroom, more hangout space, and a craft room. Students in the college program learn to live together by, well, living together. We live in an apartment like this one for the whole school year. It's the perfect amount of space for four people, most of the time. We're always learning in these apartments, whether it be independent living skills, such as cooking and cleaning, or what we call an apartment circle, which helps roommates understand each other's wants and needs. Learning to live in an apartment is a big step. It can be a little scary at first, but it's worth it.
So when we're not going to classes, going to the mall, hanging out, cooking, cleaning, hiking, making art, playing music, playing board games, playing hockey, sledding, starting clubs, building computers, making movies, finding world domination, riding the bus, grocery shopping, doing laundry, helping our neighbors, meeting with our advisors, or spending time by ourselves, we're working on careers. We're going to head over to the Career Center. That's just two blocks this way.
There are several career certificates you can earn here. Retail, culinary, hospitality, and health services. But don't worry about making that choice all on your own. Inside, you'll meet with staff, including full-time job developers who will help you find the best fit for you and your abilities. They work really hard to build partnerships with local businesses nearby, like Best Buy headquarters right over there. For the career certificate program, we practice work skills at practicum sites around the city. And we prepare for those in Career Center classrooms, like this one. And you can go to the staff offices for support from career staff. They'll help you with searching for a new gig or with maintaining your current one. You can even do a mock job interview here. For the culinary certificate, students learn food prep here in this industrial kitchen here at Wood Lake. That's hot, but very delicious. Since graduating the college program, I decided to participate in the community program, which offers participants sports services, social activities, and a wonderful space to enjoy.
Hey,
how's it going?
Good. Hi, Evan.
Hey, John. Emily. Hey, Bradley. We're pretty friendly around here. Anyway, once you've joined, you can participate as long as you want, your whole life even. This house is the center of the action.
Oh.
This is the main level of the house. We have couches and a TV. We have a meeting area over here. We have internet access.
and we have a kitchen. There's also a band practice room and a small fitness studio. Our community specialists are here upstairs. They meet with each of us on a regular basis. So no matter where you are on your journey of independence, you'll find the support you need at MICC. And that's our tour. We hope to see you very soon. Bye for now. Hey, how's it going? I'm just giving this virtual tour.
So that's our campus. The challenges facing autistic and neurodiverse young adults are significant. Only 1/3 of individuals with autism pursue any form of post-secondary education. Fewer than half secure paid employment within 4 years of graduating high school. And 87% continue to live with their parents well into adulthood. For many, that results in severe social isolation. The statistics are not a reflection of ability or ambition. They are a reflection of a lack of opportunity. MICC is changing that. Throughout the annual report, you will see some of MICC's accomplishments. I am most proud of page 22. 95% of MICC participants who are eligible are employed. We recognize the importance of addressing Minnesota's workforce shortage, and MICC is playing a vital role in preparing neurodiverse individuals for careers in high-demand fields. Our career certificate programs, endorsed by Century College, provide specialized training in digital careers, food, service and hospitality, health and human services. Our careers curriculum is certified by Century College annually. During our most recent audit, Century College was quoted as saying, MICC should be applauded for their continuous program modifications and improvements. Century College is proud to be associated with MICC's success. MICC students and graduates contribute to Minnesota's economy, working in more than 50 different local employers, including Bachman's, Delta, Walgreens, Presbyterian Homes, Speedway, the Guthrie, Great Wolf Lodge, Mall of America, and many, many more. Through our comprehensive college program, students gain the skills to live independently, secure meaningful employment, and find a sense of belonging in their communities. Each year, it is estimated that 100,000 individuals on the autism spectrum turn 18 nationwide. In Minnesota, that number of students with ASD receiving special education services has increased by 138% since 2009. The demand for programs like MICC is growing rapidly, and we are committed to expanding our reach to meet this need, and by expanding our current program in Ridgefield, and by looking for expansion opportunities in other parts of Minnesota. MICC delivers a substantial financial return on investment for the state of Minnesota. A study by Wilder Research found that for every dollar invested in MICC, the state sees a $38 return. This impact extends beyond the financials. It represents lives transformed, families supported, and a workforce strengthened. Thank you all for your support. Your continued investment in MICC truly changes lives. It empowers young adults with autism and neurodiverse differences to have a college experience, achieve independence, secure employment, and build meaningful social connections. We are proud to partner with you in making Minnesota a leader in inclusive education and workforce development. It is now my pleasure to introduce two remarkable MICC students, Abby and Julia, who will share their experiences and the profound impact MICC has had on their lives.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
I'm Abby Wendland. Hello, my name is Abby Wendland. I'm from Dalton, Minnesota, and I graduated from high school in 2019. After graduation, I lived at home and worked at a nursing home for a few years, not sure what I would do next. Thankfully, my mom found MICC through a caseworker at her job. After learning more and visiting MICC, I decided to apply because I wanted to be part of a learning community where people understand and support me. The students at MICC share similar experiences, and the staff know how to help us. Over the past 3 years at MICC, I have gained skills that have helped me become more independent. I have learned how to effectively clean and maintain my apartment, manage my medications, and budget my finances responsibly. Most importantly, MICC has helped me prepare for the workplace. I will graduate from MICC in May with a certificate in Health and Human Services. Through my classroom work and hands-on practicum experiences, I have the knowledge and tools to be successful in my career. Thanks to MICC's training and support, I feel confident in my ability to enter the workforce. After graduation, I will be moving into my own apartment and working at my new job as a dietary aide at the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis. I am also excited to join MICC's community program, which will allow me to stay connected with my friends and receive continued support from staff when needed. Thank you for your time and everything you do to support MICC and our students.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name is Julia Chaplesky. Hi, my name is Julia Chaplesky. I'm from Winona, and I graduated high school before coming to MICC. In high school, I did Future Farmers of America and theater. I had three great friends in Winona that I still connect with. I found MICC with a caseworker through the county. I am supported by my family and my dog and my loved ones. I came to MICC because of my disability, and I needed extra support for independent transportation and learning about finances and social skills. Since starting at MICC, I know more about social dynamics. I have learned more about independent travel and independent living. I have also done better at learning to identify my emotions. I'm proud of the friends I have made and the places I have gone. Staff at MICC have helped me by guiding me through tough decisions and situations. It gave me great advice when I needed. My friends are close to and kind to me and help me through different situations in life, even when I am anxious and in distress. I chose a Health and Human Services certificate at MICC. Through my practicum, I have gained important knowledge and workplace safety, including bloodborne pathogens and HIPAA regulations. I will use that knowledge in the workplace. After graduation, I will be living in an apartment with a roommate, further building my independence and working at my new job at Minnesota Valley Surgical Center. One of my dreams is to travel. I would love to visit Europe someday. Ultimately, I hope to become a phlebotomist and use the skills I've gained to help others. Thank you for supporting MICC. I would also like to invite you to attend MICC's gala on March 15th, where I will be featured in a special video. I hope to see you there.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you have more presentation? Because I was kind of hoping that you would talk about the $4 million that you got in the last biennium from this committee. So it was $2 million and $2 million that you received.
It was one and one?
Yeah. Oh, am I reading the spreadsheet wrong? Okay. I stand corrected, one and one. So if you could speak to what you use that funding for, and I know that in your annual report on page 6, it has revenue and expenses at a high level.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and so we use that funding as need-based financial assistance to Minnesota residents, as well as tuition reduction and pulling down the cost of our tuition for our participants and students.
Okay. And also on page 6, you've got revenue and expenses. Do you want to just speak to that just briefly?
Can I get a copy of that? Thank you. And you would like me to address the...
So in your annual report, as Gunmi said, you've got revenue and expenses. It's at a very high level. And you've got government grants at 26% of your gross revenue coming in. Do you want to just speak to this page just a little bit That would be helpful.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yep.
Are you on the page now? Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
We are on the same page.
Ms. Goodmeestead.
Okay, so we, as far as our revenue goes, we have our, we have program fees that we take, which would be considered our tuition that comes through for our programs. That would be reflected in the college program, community program, and careers, and our social. Our government grants are, which is what we receive through the Office of Higher Education, and the breakdown on that is roughly $1 million dollars from this committee and $625,000 from K-12. Last year we were able to receive some funding from the from DEED, which is $450,000 to go towards our careers program. And then there's some other breakdowns as far as the Minnesota State's Arts Board. There was some funding that goes towards our social program there.
Thank you. So I did look back in the spreadsheet. I'm going to go to our nonpartisan, though, because I was pretty sure it was 2 and 2, so 4 in the biennium. And Mr. Savory, what do you see on the Chapter 41 spreadsheet?
Madam Chair and Member, just a bit of history on this appropriation. The base in FY24-25 was $2 million. And the subsequent base in the tails in FY26-27 was $2 million. The other body came in with a position that they would like to allocate $4 million in FY24-25 only and leave the tails in 26-27 as zero. That was an accepted component of the conference report and thus passed by the legislature. So in FY24-25, the total appropriation for MICC is $2 million in the first year, $2 million in the second year for a total of four. Because of that, there is no base in FY26-27.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Okay, so just to be on the same page, literally, so on Chapter 41, the spreadsheet that we've been working from for 2 months, I think. So, yeah, so Ken, Mr. Savory was correct. It's on the spreadsheet that we did a $4 million appropriation with zero in the tails, which is why we don't have them in the base. That was a compromise in conference committee. Representative Cleburne, did you have a question?
I was confused because reading the spreadsheet. So you're saying we gave them $2 million in 24 and $2 million in 2025?
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Cleburne, if you look at line number 339 on the spreadsheet, I believe you're looking. So I believe those are the changes from base. So the change from base was $2 million. The actual appropriation was two and two.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Cleburne. Yeah, that was the change from base. And so just to reiterate, that was we did $2 million in FY24, $2 million FY25, making it $4 million for the total. What we appropriated last session, leaving zero in the base or in the tails. And so we have zero right now, which is why they're here saying, please put us back into the base. But they had received $4 million in the previous biennium. Absolutely, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your being here. And I do greatly appreciate the work that you do. I'm always confused by this. So today you mentioned that you are endorsed by Century College. Are you, in fact, and this is the piece I'm confused by, so just forgive me, are you, in fact, an accredited college?
We are not.
Ms. Goodmeestead.
Thank you.
Sorry.
No, not in that sense, no.
Okay.
That's Representative Cleburne.
No, it's always confusing to me, right? Because we talk about college, we talk about programs, and these life skills are really important. And I don't want to do anything to take away from the life skills, but I've always questioned, because they do great work in this area, I have always questioned in my mind why it's the higher ed budget and not DEED or DHS, where other supportive services are also located.
Representative Cleburne, these are fantastic questions. I'm so glad you're asking them. These are questions that need to be asked, and I don't think that we've asked in the past. They had a brief presentation, I believe, last biennium, so these are the right questions to ask. Thank you.
But I just want to acknowledge the fact that I love the work that you do. I think it's really important. Thank you.
Their video was fantastic. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. So I heard a Thank you, ladies, for being here so much and for the wonderful addition you're making into human services. I think that's wonderful. But I did hear people chat a little bit about their case managers and about some of those, and I looked through your financials, and because government funds kind of goes into one big box, it wasn't totally clear how much waiver dollars you're getting from CDCSs, CSGs. I know you're not an enrolled Medicaid provider, but my understanding is that you are able to take funds from CDCS waiver dollars. So how much Medicaid waiver dollars are part of that government funds part of your report?
Representative Hicks, I'm going to help you out here, because I'm so in the packet that was provided in the very last page, it has all of that, the very, very last two pages. I know it's meaty.
I'm sorry, I must have missed it. I looked through.
There's a lot there, Representative Hicks. There's a lot. So there is the breakdown, because I asked them to do that before they came. And they have a breakdown of all the government sources, including the waiver programs, including their rehab services. They have two different waiver programs and the rehab services.
Can you please point us to what you're looking
at? Yes, ma'am. Okay. So Representative Claiborne, this is, you have that. Go to the very last two pages. Yep, now we are literally all on the same page. We've said that a lot this biennium. Representative Hicks.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So I see where it says states. Is that? Am I looking at the right spot?
Representative Hicks, that's the wrong packet. So you want the packet that says Mahoney, which is the auditor, and then it says Minnesota Independent College and Community, and their consolidated financial reports packet. I'll give you a second to get to it.
No. Great. Thank you. That's very helpful. And then the Voc Rehab program fees help me understand as well. Oh, and also the waivers from Wisconsin. So the deed dollars up above, so the Minnesota Department of Economic Employment and Economic Development, that's deed. Voc Rehab is part of deed. These are separated on here. So the $500,000 that's from deed that isn't Voc Rehab dollars, can you help me understand what those funds are?
Yes. Ms. Hope, you said. That those deed dollars are applied to the programming and the education and the curriculum that we're providing to in our careers program, so the certificates that we are teaching and the job development that we are doing.
Representative Hicks.
So then I assume the Voc Rehab dollars below must be for your community your postgraduate?
Go ahead,
Ms. Goodman.
In addition to our college program, we have a work readiness program that is it's actually very new as a result of the deed, that is bringing, allowing people that are not enrolled in our college program to take the certificate program independent, so they're not living on campus with us and doing that full immersed experience. They're doing more of a sessions, individual sessions. So it's a different type of program.
Representative Hicks.
So I know you're CARF accredited. So are any of these Voc Rehab dollars, are any of these job readiness, job placement, customized employment, any of those services?
Ms. Goodmeestead.
I would have to double check on that specifically.
Representative Hicks.
So the reason I'm asking is because Voc Rehab is in a bit of a financial pinch. They're about $19 million short for their projections in vocational rehabilitation services. And vocational rehabilitation, in my opinion, is one of the most valuable programs for people with disabilities seeking employment. And so whenever I'm seeing where Voc Rehab is spending their money, I have questions about exactly which services. Because if those services are not directly related to getting people with disabilities skills and employment, then I want to talk about that, because the $19 million that deed is short is going to drastically impact the opportunity for people with disabilities to find and obtain and maintain competitive integrated employment. So that's why I was asking. So I would really, if you wouldn't mind, and just because I'm very invested in this Voc Rehab conversation, if you wouldn't mind letting me know what services under Voc Rehab you're billing for, and subsequent to that, if with the Voc Rehab $19 million shortfall, any of those are in danger in your program, I'd also like to know that.
Ms. Goodmeestead.
I can get you the specifics on what billing codes and how we are doing that, but we have already been informed that many of our future participants coming through will be impacted.
Representative Hicks.
Thank
this is
Chair.
The time
I'm
for
so
Representative
sorry.
Hicks, please. This is what we're here for.
also with the waiver program, so I think a few people on this committee are probably very familiar with waiver CDCS waiver programs, but CDCS waiver programs for just quick crash course is Medicaid dollars. It's a different way to use Medicaid dollars. It allows the participant to direct their services. So instead of the entities billing Minnesota Medicaid, the participant gets a chunk of money and they can distribute it how they want to meet their needs. So, and as many of you know, we are also short in human services, in our long-term care and Medicaid. And when we talk about long-term care, CDCS waivers are part of that conversation. So when the MMB budget in the tails lists the CDC or the long-term care deficit in waivers, that is the CDCS $1.1 million. I can't even read these numbers. This money, $2 million, whatever it is. And so those are, you know, really important things to note. And so I would kind of want to know, I guess, are the waiver dollars are not going for the college courses, or those are part of the tuition, or how do all of these different funding streams come into play for a student who's trying to attend your school? So their purchase price is whatever it is, and then the waiver takes a chunk, and then our funds lower that purchase price. Like, how does that help me understand how the math maths?
Your fund, good, me said.
I'll get that right. Sorry, Madam Chair. Your funds go to the reducing the cost of the tuition first, and then when our participants or our students are coming to the school, they have various different ways in which they're paying down their tuition and their program fees. And so some families are able to use their waiver dollars to be able to apply to the courses that we are taking. The students have our course catalog. They're able to see which classes we're teaching, and if those apply to services they've been approved for, they can use it towards paying off some of their tuition.
Okay, Representative Cleborn.
Right, so you've heard me say this before to other entities, so I'll ask you. You know, I hear you say tuition, courses, tuition. What is the total cost of attendance for an individual?
Ms. Goodmead said.
The total cost is around $60,000, and that would be inclusive of the room and board.
And Ms. Goodmead said, is that a year?
Annually,
okay. I knew she was going to ask that, so.
Thank you.
Representative Cleborn.
Okay, and thank you very much, Madam Chair. And then could you tell me, okay, $60,000 includes room and board. Can you please tell me how much of that goes to room and board?
Ms. Goodmead.
Thank you, Chair. The room and board is $10,000, roughly $10,000, between $10,000 and $11,000.
Representative Cleborn.
Annually, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Cleborn.
No, that's good. That's all I needed to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleaver. And then on these last two pages of the packet that you have, so I did add it all up. So the government sources in 2024 was $4,032,765. So right at that $4 million. And then if you look at their non-government sources and their individual, so that's program fees, individual donations, investment income, things like that. That was $3.8 million approximately, a little bit more than that. And so they are almost at 50-50 with government sources and non-government sources. That was in the 2024 year. So, but a question I have, though, is we looked at the spreadsheet and we know that you got $2 million in 24 and $2 million in 25. And you said on your sheet here, it says Office of Higher Education, and you've got $922,000. Mm-hmm. And also via OHE, you have K-12 at $625,000. But that doesn't, I'm not sure what that means, because I know you got $2 million from, it was $2 million and $2 million. So I'm wondering if you could explain the difference, Ms. Goodness.
Ms. Chair, thank you. My understanding is these are our numbers as of February 24th, so there's dollars that still have not yet been spent. So that's why there's the discrepancy there.
Ms. Gummie said, is it a reimbursement? And so you expend and then you send in your receipts and you get reimbursed from OHE?
Correct.
Okay. Perfect. That explains it. Thank you.
How many students?
So I'm going to ask you, so we don't have to go back and forth. How many students do you serve, Ms. Goodmeestead?
In our college program, we have 55, and then beyond that, we have another 120.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Oh, yes, Representative Wolgamott, Lead Wolgamott.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. First of all, I would like to say thank you to our student testifiers who are here today. Wow, Julie, Abby, thank you for sharing your stories. It is so inspiring and so powerful. And I think that I know that everyone in this committee and really the whole state is proud of your hard work and your growth and everything that you've done to achieve the success that you've achieved. So thank you again for being here to share your testimony and congratulations on all your success. It's really, really inspiring. Madam Chair, I had a question for Ms. Goodmeestead. You outlined the sort of what you've done with the $4 million that you received from the 24-25 biennium and appreciate that update. Could you shed some light on what is the cost of doing nothing as we're looking at this next biennium? What would it mean for students in Minnesota who are autistic and neurodivergent? What opportunities would be missed if the status quo remains and you remain zeroed out of the 26-27 biennium?
Ms. Goodmeestead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would bring tears to my eyes, actually, to think about that. There's nothing like MICC in the country. Minnesota is very advanced in the work that they're doing with adults on the autism spectrum and neurodivergence. There's not an attitude anywhere else that there's any education after 18. So there's very limited opportunities for folks like Julia and Abby to get more exposure and experience. We take for granted that we can be able to build the skills that we need and pick up on the nuances of the world. And what MICC is providing is not only the chance to get that workforce certificate, but they're also getting the chance to learn how to be successful as they live independently. So they are not only, they're moving out of their apartments, moving out of their parents' homes and into apartments and staying in an independent. They are becoming active members of the community. They are showing up to their legislative sessions. They are voting. They are giving back to the community. So if MICC were not to exist, there wouldn't be that step out of their parents' homes or out into the community with that safe learning environment. So I would say you would see less adults in the workforce and more adults depending on their parents, which in the long term is not what we want, because what happens when their parents are no longer there to be providing their support?
Thank you, Ms. Goodmeestead. Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you very much for laying that out for us. And another question that I had, Madam Chair, over the years that I've served on the Higher Education Committee, I've heard sometimes it gets mentioned, the MICC, we can kind of absorb that work through some of the other schools. Maybe there's a program at St. Cloud State for adults on the autistic spectrum, neurodivergent, or, oh, there's a program over here. My question is, can you explain the difference between maybe a student going to a program at one of the other colleges, universities? What is the difference of the experience that they're getting by getting to come to the MICC? Where is the value of having that kind of all-inclusive learning opportunity instead of being in a different environment, if that makes sense?
Ms. Goodmeestead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is unique about MICC is our urban learning environment. So while other universities have fantastic programs, what we are teaching is how to actually go and live in the in a community where you will live long term. So it is not a college campus per se, like you would see at these big schools. We are actually in Richfield, and our participants are learning how to use the city bus, how to get a job, how to do their own grocery shopping. So it's a real immersive community education experience, which is our peer groups out across the United States are very isolated in like a ranch style or other kind of settings where you would never fully have that long-term independence. And the outcomes we're seeing is long-term sustainable independence, living on their own with employment. We have graduates up to 20 years now that we've been around have been living on their own and taking care of themselves.
Representative Woldemont.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to follow up on that as well. Can you maybe give us some more insights as far as safety goes? Would you say that students who go to MICC and participate, in the college experience at MICC are set up to be more safe than they would be if they were going to a program at a different campus?
Ms. Goodmeestead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is an interesting question, and I know that you're familiar with our program. Our students will tend to be more vulnerable out in the community, which is why our learning environment is critical that they are going out and learning the skills necessary to be successful. Not only are we teaching things simple as where to sit on the city bus and when to pull out your wallet and when not, all the way to being introduced to the local police department, fire departments, Richfield first responders are some of our teachers that actually come to class and teach our participant skills. We have a fabulous relationship with our first responders in the area. But that isn't just because they're supporting each other. It's because they're interacting in a learning experience and providing scenarios and how to problem solve, take care of themselves. Yep.
Thank you. Representative Woldemont.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have more to say and have more questions, but I know we're being respectful of time. So I'll just close by saying thank you for those answers. And again, thank you to the students. I know that our state is getting a great return on the investment when we invest in the work that the MICC is doing to make sure that all of our adults on the autism spectrum who are neurodivergent are getting the skills that they need to live independently. And again, 95%, wow, to have 95% of students there in the workforce, that's incredible. What a great return on investment for our state. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, and thank you to the students for testifying. It's so nice to meet you, and it's so nice to have you in the committee and your colleagues who are supporting in the chairs here. I have been to MICC, colleagues, and if you haven't gone on one of their tours, I really encourage you to do it. It's an incredible campus. It's a wonderful place. And I also just want to, I appreciate all the workforce comments. It's fantastic, and I really think there's a lot of value to society for the work they contribute to whatever sphere they're working in, but also for the students, for the meaning, for the independence, for learning the financial skills. And my nephew is neurodivergent, and I learned about this program when he was too old to apply. And it has always broken my heart that I didn't know about it earlier. And he is also doing really well. He has a job and is doing fantastic. But I think the independent skills that are developed for cooking and cleaning and transportation, all those things are just so critical to the point you made that when the parents are no longer able to care for those young people, that they have grown into doing it themselves with support. And so thank you for your work. Thank you, ladies, for being here and sharing your stories. We're so proud of you, and congratulations on your graduation.
We have one more question. Representative Cleburne has the final question because we do have two more presentations after, but please go ahead.
No, it's okay. I was just wondering, $4 million is a lot of state money.
Yes.
Plus the other monies that are in the program. I'm just wondering how many students are there on full scholarship, how many students are on partial scholarship. What does that look like, right? I mean, I looked at the donor base. There are some pretty hefty donors in this 990 as well. And I'm just wondering, I always like to get the most bang for our buck. So how many students are being served with these state dollars?
That's a great question. Let's go back to that. Ms. Goodmeestead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have, because we're reducing the tuition, I would say everybody is getting impacted by these dollars. And then we have on top of that, another 60% of the participants would be getting a financial assistance as well.
And Ms. Gooden, we said, could you repeat this, how many students? And then you had another category. Mm-hmm. If you could repeat that information too, so we have that. Ms. Gooden,
Madam Chair. So our entire community that we are working with is over 100, yeah, add them together, about 155 participants. There's 55 that are specifically in that room and board living experience, and that is 3 years, and then there's a graduation. There are core competencies that they need to achieve, skill levels, there's report cards that they have to be able to make it through the entire program, and that's that smaller group.
Good. Representative Cleburne.
You know, not all financial assistance is the same, right? So some people may be receiving $1,000 and some could be receiving $10,000. When you get back, if you could maybe provide to the chair a fuller breakout of what students receive, you know, not their names, of course, I don't want their names, but just the number of students who are receiving full, the number who are receiving maybe 75, 50, 25. Just a broad idea of how many students then are being served that way. Thank you so much.
So I'm Cleburne, and I believe there's a member on the committee that will be bringing a bill, and they'll come back for a very specific ask. And so that is teeing that up.
Awesome.
Yes. And Representative Allen.
Sorry, the longer this goes on, the more I think about things. Sorry. Madam Chair.
Representative Allen, that is how all of our brains are working at the same time. So thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for taking the time to be here to testify today. I can appreciate everything that you're doing and what it takes to get up and testify in front of this committee, and we are all appreciative of how you've come along and what you've learned. Just real quick question, you don't have to answer it now, but if you come back with those numbers, if you could come back with which students are coming from within, you know, how many are within the state of Minnesota, which ones are coming from out of state, mm-hmm. I'd appreciate that as well. So, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Allen. I feel like this committee is just firing on all cylinders right now. Like, we're really digging into, we've had enough caffeine. We've all had lunch or something. I don't know. Thank you so much, MICC, for coming to testify. We will have you back again. I believe there's going to be a bill that will be dropped, and you've got a specific ask. So this tees all that up, and thank you. And also, I should note to the committee as well that they did provide 3 years of audits and financial 990s, and that is all on the website. But that is a lot of paper, and we have a limit how much we can print. And so I gave you 1 year's worth. So, but it is all on the website on our committee page, and then of course the summary is the last two pages. So hopefully that is helpful as we figure this all out, and we've asked some great questions. And with that, we will let you go. Thank you so much, and we'll bring up our next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Next presentation. Thank you, committee, for sticking with us. Okay, next up to the committee is Addiction Medicine Fellowship. There'll be a couple folks from the University of Minnesota and one from Hennepin Health if you want to make your way up here. And their slide presentation is in your packets. Again, that's the Minnesota Addiction Medicine Fellowship is who we're working with now. As you get settled in, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Let's see, who's going to start us off? Whoever's going to start us off, go ahead and state your name for the record, and as you get your slide presentation up and going.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Dr. Sheila Specker, and I am a family physician and addiction psychiatrist at the University of Minnesota and the program director for the Addiction Medicine Fellowship.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I have two other faculty that are with me today and will participate in this testimony.
Okay.
Dr. David Peter, who is to my right, is my associate program director, a family physician, and at the VA Medical Center. And to my left is Dr. Charles Reznikoff from Hennepin Healthcare. And so we will all be sharing some of our perspectives about the program.
Dr. Specker, go right ahead.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to share a bit of history about the program, since some of you may not be familiar with the addiction medicine program. I think we were here a couple years ago requesting funding, and I don't think very many of you were probably on the committee at that time. So I'm going to provide a little bit of a background and history, say who we are. We're going to share a little bit about what our curriculum is, how we train physicians in addiction medicine, and who our graduates are and how they serve Minnesota. And Dr. Reznikoff is going to share his perspective from Hennepin, and this grant is specifically to Hennepin. So thank you. So the Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program was supported by the legislature in 2 years ago to train 6 physicians in the subspecialty of addiction medicine, and with specifically to support a stipend that would be sent to Hennepin County Medical Center to specifically used to prepare physicians in addiction medicine for multiple areas in the state of Minnesota, underserved areas, train physicians in interviewing, in diagnosing, in motivational interviewing, counseling skills, medication management with all of our opioid therapies in particular. So a little bit of history of the program. So this program began in 1982, and all three of us sitting at this table are graduates of our addiction medicine program. So it speaks something to what we do when we graduate. So this is a subspecialty. So physicians entering addiction medicine can come from any specialty, which is, I think, appeal. There's no specialty that owns addiction. It's everywhere. It's pervasive. So most of our physicians that have entered the program come from primary care, internal medicine, family medicine, but quite wide disciplines: anesthesiology, surgery, emergency medicine, psychiatry, dermatology, radiology, pediatrics, et cetera. It's a 12-month program. It is a clinical fellowship, although there's multiple opportunities to participate in research projects or QI projects with the fellows. And yearly we train between 1 and 3. Now, with the legislative funding, we've been able to train more. So for the past 2 years, we've trained 4 each year. We've applied to expand the program and received permission from the ACGME, American College of Graduate Medical Education, to do so. So we've expanded our, and it sounds like it is a small program. It sounds like it's a small program, but when you hear about what our fellows do when they graduate, you might appreciate the importance. So we were accredited as soon as we could be accredited by the ACGME in 2018. And like I said, the legislative funding has allowed us to expand and train 6 fellows in a biennium. And I have been the program director for over 20 years or so. So generally, addiction medicine is a medical subspecialty. So it's designated under the American Board of Preventive Medicine, which I think is appropriate because we talk about addiction as an adolescent disease, essentially, because most of addiction will begin in adolescence. So the sooner we can intervene, the faster we can intervene with our therapies and so forth and prevention, the better the outcome. So we're focused on prevention, diagnosis, treatment, delivery of comprehensive addiction care to adults, to children, adolescents that have substance use, and a lot of co-occurring problems, as you might imagine, depression, anxiety, et cetera. And so developing the skills that are needed to be not just a good clinician, but to also be a consultant to primary care, to mental health providers, to the school systems, the community, agencies, and other programs that have that serve those with substance use disorders.
I'm going to pause you just for a second because I can tell some folks are wondering where you are in our spreadsheet because we've lived in the spreadsheet. I knew that Representative Liebling was looking for it. So It is under the addiction medicine. It was $270,000 and $270,000 for a total of $540,000 for the biennium. So that's the appropriation. Was that, I knew you were looking for it. So. Oh, what line? Okay, that's a really good question, Representative Liebling. And it depends on which spreadsheet you're looking at, but it's either line 60 or line 20, depending on if you're on the Chapter 41 spreadsheet, that's line 60, and if you're on the consolidated one, that's line 20. Is everybody on the same page now? It's not a large appropriation, but they are small but mighty, it seems. Okay.
Right. And we'll get to a slide on that also.
Thank you. I just knew that they were looking for that because
absolutely.
We've all been trained to go to the spreadsheet first and figure out what we're talking about because that helps us to know who you are and what we've done in the past. So please continue.
Thank you,
Dr. Chair.
So we have a mighty faculty as well. So we have site directors at each of our main sites. So it's really a joint effort between Hennepin County Medical Center, the University of Minnesota, the VA Medical Center, and Allina at Abbott Northwestern. So these are our main locations, and so we have site directors at each of these locations. And these are just some of our key faculty that support our program. And as you can see, they're from multiple locations. So the past 2 years, so you're interested in what has happened with the money, basically, the appropriations over the past 2 years. So we've been able to, for the first time, have four fellows of each at each year. So, and these are the backgrounds. So family medicine, internal medicine, three family medicine in 2023, 2024, and I'll say a little bit later about what they're doing. And then this current year, we have internal medicine, pediatric resident, background, family medicine and emergency medicine. So I'm going to turn this over right now to Dr. Peter, who will explain a little bit more about the curriculum for the program.
Welcome to the committee again. Please state your name again for the record and then continue with the slide presentation that you have.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is David Peter. I'm a family medicine physician, also boarded in addiction medicine. I was trained here at the University of Minnesota at Smiley's Family Medicine Residency, and then the Addiction Medicine Fellowship at the University of Minnesota, so a former fellow. And going back to that list that Dr. Specker showed a moment ago, if you saw that the leadership was pretty much all former fellows. I don't know if you noticed those asterisk symbols. And that's part of speaking to our greater impact we'll get to, that we're not training our clinicians. We'll train them to be expert clinicians in this field, people to look to them for answers, but also to go out there and train others. We can't train enough physicians in addiction alone through our fellowship. We know that. It's a big problem that covers the entire state. But we can, encourage other providers to be more open to the concept of treating addiction in their own clinics and being resources for them. So that's kind of what our role is, to train them to be, leaders and advocates and educators. So the aims of the fellowship are to create those clinical skills that we talked about. That is the core, to make sure they're experts so they can handle everything from, acute withdrawal management to more long-term management. We also want to make sure that they can recognize that addiction doesn't exist in isolation. There's often a lot of history of trauma, family dynamics, socioeconomic circumstances, often a lot of comorbid mental health conditions that need to be taken into context when treating. So we want to make sure that they have exposure. That's partly why our fellows also train in mental health. Through our program. We're housed in the Department of Psychiatry, for instance. We want to make sure we integrate, whole person care, so somatic, pharmacologic, psychotherapeutics into their treatment to improve outcomes across the entire recovery trajectory, not just while they're in a treatment center. We want to make sure they have goals and aftercare that can help support them longitudinally. And then, as I mentioned before, we want them to become leaders and teachers to then spread this message, reduce stigma and bias, so we can actually, improve addiction as a whole across the state. So our curriculum is robust. It covers, again, all these topics from epidemiology to, social determinants of health to more, novel substances of use that we might be hearing about coming down every year. Things are changing rapidly, and so it's important to keep on top of the most recent research. Our fellows are involved in, didactic curriculums that we create for the psychiatry residency. We're also expanding to create that for the family medicine residencies. They're involved at both the national and regional level in the American Society of Addiction Medicine, where they speak actually at national conferences. They also speak at the Minnesota Society of Addiction Medicine, which I'm president of currently. And they do a talk at least one or two every single year to educate themselves and others about kind of upcoming novel substances of use and their impacts. And part of what we make sure they learn during this curriculum is that, as Dr. Specker said, this is something that we have to begin early. This we have to, you know, check in with, you know, educating people when they're very, very young to make sure that we prevent people developing a severe substance use disorder. And then we also want to screen them early on and then do brief interventions to make sure they don't develop a severe use disorder. And then, unfortunately, if they do develop a more severe use disorder, you know, train our fellows to recognize that and give appropriate levels of service and then the aftercare they need to have, you know, recovery long term. So in order to do this, we have four core sites. This is kind of the easiest way to look at it. And the fellows spend on average about 3 months at each site. So the University of Minnesota is split into kind of three major groups. There is a detoxification. They spend a month there doing withdrawal management, essentially. They spend a month on an adolescent service to make sure they kind of understand how to do that prevention and early intervention. And then they spend a month on a residential treatment service where they get to actually go through with people in recovery to see what they get, you know, out of these groups, but also then help treat them as providers and then see them in clinic afterwards so they can then see the transition as they go from being acutely in withdrawal and needing, you know, that kind of level of care to what it looks like a month or two down the road or even 6 months down the road, how it shifts in terms of their needs. They spend about 3 months at the VA, where I work also. That's under actually the Comprehensive Pain Center because we know, again, that addiction doesn't exist in isolation, so that often there is comorbid pain that influences substance use. And so learning about how these two interrelates and how it's important to treat it all together. They also work there at the university back some of the days in what's called the recovery clinic. And that is a kind of walk-in low barrier access clinic, also called bridge clinics at some places, where people can walk in off the street at any time, essentially, when it's open, and access care for opioid use disorder same day, which is pretty remarkable. They also work at Hennepin Healthcare, which Dr. Reznikoff will speak about more in a minute, but it's an inpatient consult service, very high acuity, and you have patients there who have, you know, infections in their valves of their heart, who might be pregnant, who have substance use disorder, so seen kind of from all these different avenues. They also work in a methadone outpatient treatment program while they're there, as well as an outpatient clinic. And then Alina is kind of a newer partner, and that is also an inpatient consult service, a little bit different demographic than I would say at Hennepin, but same kind of idea, that high acuity kind of acute care. And as I already mentioned somewhat, they are educators and leaders. So we have created a 8-hour per year didactic curriculum now for the psychiatry residency. We're looking to expand that into family medicine to make sure that our other residents learn a lot about addiction and feel comfortable treating it as a whole. They presented at the American Society of Addiction Medicine and region, like I mentioned before. And I'll pass it back to Dr. Specker now.
Dr. Specker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So finances. That was what you were looking for earlier. So as we've said, the stipend support for at this particular level, which is a PGY-5 level, this year is $78,800 and some dollars, and goes off roughly about 5% every year. However, that's not the total cost, obviously, to train a fellow. There's not just direct costs, but there's the programmatic costs and the costs for faculty. I mean, we're teachers, and in order to run a program and to teach, it requires support, financial support. So the funding support that we're very grateful for is the $540,000 every each biennium that we distribute depending on how many we have in a particular year. So we had four stipends, for instance, that were used the first year, and so we had two for this coming year. So the other stipend support is supported by the other institutions. We've always been hampered, I would say, through the years since I've been doing this for so many years with funding because CMS dollars weren't providing funding for fellowships. That was kind of a core issue, and that doesn't provide the funding that's needed to actually run a program or to pay faculty to teach. So the current support that we have is the $90,000 per fellow, which does cover the stipend and some other direct costs such as benefits, healthcare, etc. And our goal is, of course, to continue to train this number of fellows. I think having four fellows has been a very robust experience for all of the fellows. So we're very excited to continue this process and expand into other areas, such as other underserved areas, and we have ideas about how to do that. So the state mission is to prepare the physicians to practice in areas where they're needed. And there are multiple ways of doing this in rural and underserved areas. We're going to be expanding into some of those areas that we've not been in before. We really want to train our physicians to be leaders. Somebody's got to run the program. Somebody's got to do teaching. And in all different settings, inpatient, outpatient, medications, team-based, et cetera. So what happens? What has happened with our fellows? Okay, so they all have become board certified that are eligible, that have completed the program. And these are what some of our fellows have done, so recent fellows. So we have a fellow who just went to southeastern Minnesota to serve a population, southeastern Minnesota, near Gunderson Clinic, for instance. We have a fellow that has gone up to Duluth and has run an inpatient toxicology and addiction service, but also provide care throughout northern Minnesota in the Essentia system via telehealth. So telehealth is one of those areas that we really need to train, that we train our fellows in. Taking on leadership positions within the fellowship. We've had a fellow that has gone to Native American Reservation. We follow that has taken on, there are several that have joined Hennepin, our Hennepin faculty, a very underserved population. We have a fellow who just took a position at Community University Healthcare Center, CUC Clinic, which some of you know is a FQHC clinic, very much in need of an underserved population. So this is just an example of what some of our fellows have been doing. So at this point, what I want to do is turn this over to Dr. Reznikoff to talk about Hennepin and kind of expansion of our addiction services out into the greater Minnesota area community. Dr. Reznikoff.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm really excited to be here to talk about the support you're giving to the Addiction Fellowship. There is only one Addiction Fellowship in Minnesota, and it produces very highly trained addiction professionals. So my name is Charlie Reznikoff. I'm an internist and addiction doc, and I'm also a graduate of this program. I work at Hennepin Healthcare, and I also work in Rice County in an addiction clinic. So I'm going to do something a little different. This is really informative what we heard already, but I'm going to give you some real-life instances and sort of humanize the work we're doing, and then talk a little bit about Hennepin, but it's really not just about Hennepin. So these are all examples of patients that I've seen recently with fellows by my side. So last year, I was asked to do a consultation on a businesswoman who was emergently transported to Hennepin County Medical Center after a car crash. She lived in Greater Minnesota. And while the surgeons and the critical care doctors were taking care of her, really saving her life, she revealed she had a pain pill addiction, part of the reason she had the car crash. So they consulted our team, and then we helped her get sober and stay sober and also recover from her car crash. I see her regularly by telemedicine because she lives in Greater Minnesota, and she's doing great. She's a year later, she's sober, she's back with her family, back at work. Okay, so last month I saw a 16-year-old who drank an entire bottle of liquor on a dare and then tried to drive a car. His alcohol level was 0.5, six times the upper limit of normal, and he literally would have died of alcohol poisoning had he not been emergently come to HCMC. When he woke up from his coma, he said his girlfriend broke his heart, and so he took the dare. So we were able to convene, meet with the parents. We created a plan for safety. He is doing really well, and he's following up with an addiction professional in an adolescent addiction clinic at HCMC. So as I mentioned, I travel to Rice County to see patients 10% of my time. Lonsdale, Minnesota was the site of my clinic for a long time. So I recently met a husband and wife who live in a small town, who have blue-collar jobs. They have two children under the age of five and who are both addicted to fentanyl. And so I was able to help get them onto buprenorphine and provide them couples counseling so that they don't undermine each other's sobriety, which is a thing that couples can do. And so far, fingers crossed, they're doing really well. They're back at work. They're sober. And I think we maybe all would say this, but one of the absolute highlights of my work is to see the children of people in recovery when they come into the clinic with mom. And I know that mom navigated sobriety and pregnancy and motherhood all with our help. But these kids, they're just like happy toddlers. They have no clue. They have no clue what mom's been through. But there they are in the clinic like a happy, healthy kid. For example, I currently have a pregnant patient living in Faribault, Minnesota, who travels to HCMC for high-risk obstetrics because, you know, she's in recovery and she wants to navigate this process and have a healthy baby. So this is just a sample of what I do as a Minnesota fellowship-trained doc, and I'm only one of dozens in the state doing this type of work all over the state. And it's the kind of work that really only we can do, the highest level of it only we can do. We're treating addictions, and we're also giving hope to people and their families. So needless to say, I am very thankful for the Minnesota legislature and all that it's done to support the Addiction Fellowship and just addiction care in general in our state. We could not do what we do without you. We can't. So, and I think what I'll say is that what most people don't understand, and the whole point of the fellowship, is that deaths from addiction are preventable. We have really good treatments for opioid and alcohol addiction, and there are new treatments emerging for methamphetamines and other drugs. The problem is not that addiction is untreatable. The problem is that we do not have enough addiction-trained doctors. People are dying from lack of access to treatment. So funding or continuing funding the Addiction Medicine Fellowship guarantees that we will continue to train people who can provide this type of care and be an incredible benefit to Minnesota and public health in Minnesota. And this was already alluded to, but specialty trained docs, like all of us, do more than just see patients. I mean, of course we see patients. I have 800 patients addicted to fentanyl that I personally care for, but we do a lot more. So we have a colleague who's a fellowship trained doc, Dr. Brian Gran, who runs an ECHO project out of Hennepin. So what he does is support primary care doctors around the state so that they can also treat addictions. And Dr. Gran has had 1,400 pharmacists, physicians, and nurses attend his training in 46 different counties. So it's really had a huge impact on non-addiction trained docs. So that ECHO, Hennepin, and Hennepin's not the only one who has an ECHO, but that ECHO training amplifies our work. And we've already heard this long list of amazing work that our fellows have done. So I won't repeat that list. But I will say that the majority of counties in our state do not even have a single addiction-trained doctor. So it's really important to keep growing, keep building. Finally, I'll just say that, you mentioned small but mighty, the cost to support, the cost that you all support to give support to this fellowship is minimal compared to the savings that all of our work does. For example, that young man with alcohol poisoning, just his hospital bill alone would have been tens of thousands of dollars. His hospital bill alone might have trained an entire fellow. Stable funding to the Addiction Fellowship saves money for the state, ultimately, and improves access for all people to addiction treatment, and will train the leaders and teachers to combat this drug epidemic for decades to come in our state. So thank you very much for your interest, and thank you very much for your support. I'm sure we're all going to be happy to take whatever questions you have.
Thank you. I do have a question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for having these folks in. Thank you for what you do. What you kind of hit on, that several counties don't have anybody even trained. And so I am interested in, I know you have some information on the back page of your presentation, but I'm very interested in where else your fellows have gone within the state of Minnesota. Obviously there's a larger population here and in different places in the state, but I just want to make sure that we're getting y'all spread across the state so that other people in the state can benefit from what you're doing.
Dr. Specker. Madam Chair, Representative. So we recognize the importance of getting physicians out into rural areas, and that's part of our plan. So it does require utilizing probably the funding a little bit differently. It's not more money, but it's being able to send people into a rural area. So that will be one ask or one thing for us that we would want to discuss. So where else? So we do telehealth. Okay, so for instance, to the reservations in northern Minnesota. So we have patients that we do telehealth with to our clinic because we don't have the people power, basically, to have someone positioned up there. So we are fostering more connections in terms of the telehealth. So we have the Duluth and northern Minnesota area where we have a fellow. So it isn't just in Duluth, but it is that whole northern Essentia network. And then there's the southern Minnesota, southeastern Minnesota, which essentially is kind of coming from the Gunderson Clinic area, serving that population. There are addiction medicine doctors trained that are in St. Cloud Center Care. I know our psychiatry program is looking to expand into that area because that's kind of center. We've had discussions in the Baxter-Brainerd area. They're very interested in having fellows come up and train there. So that's the direction we're going. There's the other underserved areas, which is why we've been communicating with Kook, and we'll have a fellow now that will be at Kook Clinic, FQHC.
So we do have another presentation after this, and I've got two members on the list. So if we could be quick, Representative Coulter and then Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I forgive me if you discussed this while I was out of the room. Obviously the funding that you receive from the state is not the full cost of what you do. I thought I heard you say, do you receive CMS dollars? Is that what I heard you say?
Dr. Specker.
Madam Chair, Representative. So CMS dollars provide some funding, but they're not the education component. I think that's really important to say. But yes, they do see patients and you get CMS dollars, but not for faculty salaries, for instance, to train, to do the training part.
Okay. Thank you. That was helpful. I thought I heard that and I just wanted to clarify. So in terms of
Dan Coulter.
Thank you. Sorry, Madam Chair. In terms of the sort of the educational portion that you're discussing, do you receive other federal funding?
No,
Dr. Specker.
Madam Chair, Representative. We do not have other federal funding. We have funding through the institutions.
I'm going to go to Representative Liebling, and then we do have another presentation, so we'll just wrap it up after that.
Thank you. And I won't ask a question. I just want to make a short comment. And,
please.
You know, this is truly where you see the intersection of higher ed and health and medicine. And I am aware of this, and I think it's very, very important. And I just want to comment that we don't always think about addiction as a chronic disease, but it is a chronic disease as much as any other diseases, and it deserves specialty care as much as any other, certainly possibly more, because oftentimes we don't seem to do that good a job in a lot of, you know, it's a very tough disease. And I think this is a very valuable thing for the state to invest in, and I think you've all done a great job of explaining kind of the ramifications of it. I think another one might be, and I was going to maybe ask, but we don't have time, but just that, you know, there are constant new challenges in addiction, right? And so the idea of having highly trained physicians who specialize in this, who can kind of be on the cutting edge of finding new treatments and dealing with new kinds of addictions too, I think is really important for our state. So I also assume that there's some interaction with helping to train other practitioners who deal with addiction as well, not just other physicians. Like, you know, we have a whole range of people who also do addiction care at one level or another, and having these folks at the top of that pyramid is just very important. So thank you all for being here.
Representative Liebling, that's why they're here. And it really is a small amount of money in consideration to our nearly $4 billion, depending on which biennium you look at, billion-dollar budget. It's $540,000. So they've done a lot with a very little. And I'm going to finish off with Representative Cleavorn, and then we do have Hennepin Healthcare coming up to talk about their family medicine. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this awesome presentation. And it was a struggle to get this money into the higher education budget. I remember the battles going back and forth in conference committee about this money. So thank you for the great work and for being here today and letting us know how successful it was. So that's really good. The comments that I would like to make is, you know, you talked about family treating both mom and dad, right? One of the big problems that I see in our state is we don't really have family-centered substance abuse programs, right? Mom goes one place, dad goes one place, and then they get back together and, whoa, what a mess it is. So I think for us to all consider expanding that type of care and treatment as a disease program, you know, you don't share cancer, but you might share addiction. And so it's something we need to think about in the bigger picture. And I think the piece that you're talking about, that also the value of what you're doing in breaking that cycle of addiction, it may prevent generations of addiction. Each and every one of us in this room knows somebody who has an addiction problem. And it's an epidemic in our state and across our nation. So I just want to say thank you for this work, and I would really like to see the funding for this program expanded. It's really important. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Cleaver, and from someone that used to work at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, I appreciate your work. Yes. All right. With that, we're going to bring up Hennepin Health. Thank you so much for your presentation. You're small but mighty, and small amount of funding that's gone very far. So we're very excited to have had you up. Next, we have Hennepin Healthcare Family Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Walsh will be coming up with her presentation, and there is a short slide presentation in your packets. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and I'll let your folks here get yourself all set up with the slide presentation, but if you would introduce yourself to the committee.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Megan Walsh. I'm the Chief Academic and Research Officer at Hennepin Healthcare. I'm also an internal medicine physician. My helpful assistant here is
there. You go. And you are up and running, Dr. Walsh. Go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the $645,000 annual appropriation for Hennepin Healthcare's Family Medicine Residency Program. I am here to underscore the critical role this funding plays in training the next generation of family physicians and ensuring that high-quality, accessible primary care remains available to communities across Minnesota. In the next 10 years, one in six physicians is going to retire in primary care. If you live in a community that's already suffering from few primary care physicians, this is a time to pay attention and strategize. So Hennepin Healthcare's Family Medicine Residency is one of the oldest in the nation and one of the oldest in the state of Minnesota. It was created in March, nearly our anniversary, 1970. It's located, a family medicine clinic is located on 28th and Nicolet in the Whittier neighborhood in Minneapolis. What's interesting about family medicine, and it's true of our program, of Mayo, of Alina, of the University of Minnesota, family medicine programs are required to have a freestanding clinic that is solely dedicated to their training program. So you can imagine family medicine training has greater cost than other residency or fellowships programs that can roll up under the umbrella of a hospital or other freestanding clinic systems. Hennepin Healthcare as a health system encompasses 484-bed hospital in a downtown Minneapolis campus, a network of community clinics, and the clinical and specialty center at the downtown campus as well. Hennepin delivers care to everyone no matter their situation, including low-income individuals, those without health insurance, and those covered by government programs. Our mission at Hennepin is to educate family physicians to become leaders in family medicine and community health and to serve our diverse urban community.
Our vision is to be an educational center of excellence for family physicians who are competent in caring for people of diverse cultures committed to serving their community and capable of practicing in a wide variety of settings. So let's talk a little bit more about the program. This is based in downtown Minneapolis, but our graduates go all over the state. Another thing to note about family medicine, you need to have enough clinical cases from deliveries to pediatric care to adult care to geriatric care such that when you graduate, you are capable and competent to care for all types of patients and all complexities. We have 33 residents in our program, 11 per class, 1,200 applicants per year for these 11 spots. That is not unusual in family medicine. We have a 100% board pass rate for 10 years, greater than 10 years, and we have continued accreditation with no citations. So we have quality and we have impact. So let's dive a little bit deeper. Family medicine is a three-year training program, and again, spans all age groups. You need robust faculty numbers to not only a freestanding clinic, but you need the faculty that's set up by the accrediting body. We have 35 faculty in family and community medicine who specialize in a whole myriad of focus areas in family medicine, sports medicine, geriatrics, sleep medicine, adolescent, integrative and functional medicine, palliative care, and as you heard from Dr. Reznikoff and company, addiction. Deliveries. Family medicine residents need to be learning in a facility where there are a lot of deliveries because they have to be capable to deliver babies when they graduate. At Hennepin, our average baby deliveries for each resident in the 2024 graduating class was 38 babies born per resident. Again, an urban environment allows immersion in high volume so that you can walk into a community with lesser volume and perform. Patient visits. We track every single patient visit seen by every single resident, and our average number of annual visits for our residents last year was 1,826 per resident. I tried to peel back the curtain so you could get a really close look at the budget. I think it really is helpful to see. One thing discussed with the addiction team, but I'll highlight again, is residents in the eyes of accrediting bodies, in the eyes of you all in higher ed, and in the eyes of even CMS, residents have two roles. They're employees in a health system, and they are learners. So CMS offsets some costs for residents, but there is a lot of cost for the teaching portion of being in a residency, the faculty, the education, the curriculum, the software, the board prep materials, so you can pass an exam and actually practice independently. So I broke it down into the benefits components, the salary components. This is a year old data, so you can see salaries from last year. There are some costs for food and parking and accreditation and all the things. Our family medicine program represents 13% of the total trainees at Hennepin Healthcare. And then I show the revenue on the bottom. So yes, there is some CMS funding there. As you can see, it's about $47,000 per FTE, which does not even cover the mere salary of a resident, yet alone the benefits and all the other costs. There is an error on this slide. The family medicine state appropriation line under revenue no longer exists. That actually closed down by the state of Minnesota. It came out of Merck, and it is no longer a funding stream, so I have to amend my slide to show the unfavorable variance now of over $100,000 per FTE. Graduation, where do they go? I just took a slice. I thought you wouldn't want to see 11 residents per year for 5 years, but I wanted to show that we have graduated more than 550 family medicine residents in our program alone. Approximately 75% still practice in this state. 50% of our recent grads from 21 to 24 remain in Minnesota for primary care practice. And we have done surveys to see where they are now. Since 2010, 82% of our grads have continued to practice in primary care for over 10 years after graduating. So they get family medicine, they find a practice, and they stay in the field. A quick look, I won't read through all this, but you can look for the various small communities and urban centers that our graduates practice in. And again, you need the volume to be competent and capable to practice independently. What about accountability? How do I show you that the dollars that you are gifting our organization to have a family medicine residency every year, twice a year, I do an all-faculty time study, a teaching audit. How many hours have you taught? Where did you teach? Who did you teach? What did you teach? And I personally view all of that. That is how the dollars track to the teachers. We have resident experience surveys. We benchmark them nationally. We also have case numbers tracked, including PEDS numbers, adult numbers, geriatric numbers, and births to ensure workforce capability and competence.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We are at time, unfortunately. We had a lot of discussion on the previous presentations, but I actually do need to end in like 2 minutes. You have something really quick for Representative Wolgamut?
Madam Chair, it's related to our committee, not to the presentation.
Okay, great. So I'm going to ask you a question offline just because I'm trying to figure out where the $645,000 in the 2 years is landing in your spreadsheet, in your budget spreadsheet. So I'm going to ask you that offline. We have members that are heading to caucus, another meeting. And so if you need to go right ahead. Representative Wolgamont, did you have one final thing?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a question for you relating to House File 10. So you and I have been working together for 6 years. You've really earned my trust. When you tell me that you're going to do something, I've always had full faith that you are a person of your word, and I really respect you for that. And as you probably remember, on February 11th in this committee, you had gave us your word. You said, I will demand that it, meaning House File 10, comes back here, Higher Education Committee, when the final fiscal note is completed.
Which it's not done yet.
Okay, because I did see that the State Gov Committee sent the bill to Ways and Means on Tuesday morning. And so I just wanted to ask you, you know, when you told us that,
yep.
I trusted you. I trust you now. So I just wanted to get an update from you on House File 10 coming back to this committee.
Absolutely. So in order to speed up the fiscal note, we took out the portion that is just higher ed as a clone bill so that we can actually get a fiscal note as fast as possible. It was supposed to have been done on Monday, and here we are Thursday, and I still don't have it from the LBO. So we are waiting, not patiently. I've been a bit impatient about it, but we are waiting for that fiscal note so that I can bring the clone bill back here and we can have a full conversation about it. And I feel your frustration because I am in the same spot. Yeah. Representative Wolgamont.
Well, thank you for that update, Madam Chair. And you did say that you would bring House File 10 back to this committee. You didn't say that you would bring a clone bill back to this committee. You said that you would bring House File 10 back to this committee. So perhaps we'll have more conversation on that.
We can have a conversation about that offline, but it was the fiscal note was becoming a problem, and so I was trying to streamline the ability to get it back here to us. We have... You know, we still have time before we even get to first deadline. Well, first and second deadline, same day. But we will bring it back. My hope is to have... So we did do the clone so that we can just deal with the higher ed portions of it and the corresponding fiscal note for the higher ed portions. And so for sure we'll have that. It was supposed, like I said, it was supposed to be here Monday, and it's Thursday, and I don't have the fiscal note yet. No sense of bringing it back without a fiscal note. Yeah. Representative Cleaborn, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Since I serve as the DFL lead for StateGov, we were not allowed to discuss the higher ed portion of that bill at all because I asked about the fiscal note, and we were told we could only talk about Section 1. So it was really important that we keep the bill intact and that bill come back to higher ed as we originally discussed. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleaborn. Okay, so we are over time. Thank you so much for being here. I'll talk to you offline, and we are adjourned.